G'day, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 155th, The Mad Welsh King, in which we'll be meeting Jane Seymour. And I see the coronavirus is having another crack around the world, including Victoria, where they put in some restrictions. One of the restrictions is people wear face masks if they go out to stores. But of course, there was one woman who wanted to get herself on TV, refused to wear a mask and made a big deal of herself. But Bunnings put out a pretty decent ad in response. Here's a little bit of it.
Here at Bunnings Warehouse, our staff have been trained to help you with anything from gardening to tools and home handyman tips. One thing we can't help you with, though, is if you're trying to stage a political protest on social media about how wearing a mask to a shop is a breach of your human rights or whatever the fucking weird shit you're talking about, you fucking psycho. If you don't do that crazy shit, go to fucking Mitre 10. Here at Bunnings, to be honest, most of us don't really give a fuck. We're happy to smile and tell you where light bulbs are, but we honestly aren't paid enough to give a shit about discrimination laws or unlawful conditions of entry or whatever the fuck you're jabbering on about.
Let's get on with it. Marvellous Richard Wakeman there with his track Jane Seymour. But it's about a recap. Last week we caught up with Princess Mary, the real one, Dowager Queen of France and Duchess of Suffolk. And sadly she died. Oh. That fucker, Charles Brandon, remarried a teenager a few weeks later. His son's fiancée to boot. Son died. Still, that at least means we're back to one Mary, the Lady Mary for now, Henry's daughter. Now, Jane Parker, a.k.a. J. Boleyn, a.k.a. Lady Rochford, got the boot from court for trying to break up Henry and his mysterious floozy, the Imperial Lady. Anne Boleyn then put her cousin Margaret Shelton in front of Henry, and he obliged by banging her. But then he turned his eye to Jane Seymour. We had to say goodbye to our Spanish princess, Catherine of Aragon, also. Ah, oh, dead at 50. Anne perhaps had a premature birth and lost the baby, then had a miscarriage, and Henry is not happy. Worse for Anne, she may have lost the support of Tom Cromwell. We left it with a brilliant speech given by Anne to the churchy types. Marvellous stuff. But then Anne got that preacher to give a rather sharp sermon about the nobles and new men like Cromwell. It was, sure, it's fashionable to be telling the clergy that they're all doing it wrong, but is it the case that you're wanting the clergy to change, or do you just want our cash? Yeah, truth can hurt. Plus, Anne's getting involved in legislation, and Henry will say he had made this marriage seduced by witchcraft, and for this reason he considered it null. His evidence is that God hadn't given him a son. Oh, dear. So, it's about new floozy, Jane Seymour, and when are we? Let's be in January 1536. Catherine of Aragon has just died, Anne Boleyn has just miscarried, and here's Jane Seymour. She is as gentle a lady as I ever knew, and as fair a queen as any in Christendom. I do assure you, my lord, the king hath come out of hell into heaven for the gentleness in this, and the cursedness and unhappiness in the other. When you write to the king again, tell him that you do rejoice that he is so well matched with so gracious a woman as she is. Yeah, a bit of a spoiler there. Yeah. Anyway, that was Henry's half-uncle, Lord Lyle. If we're in 1536, then Jane Seymour is a 28-year-old virgin. She might have been left on the shelf. The historical fiction Jane Seymour is quiet, placid, obedient, and dull as bloody dishwater. We'll see. One of 10 kiddies of Sir John Seymour and Marjorie Wentworth. Good sign. Her mum knows how to knock the kiddies out. Bit of a nothing family, really, landed gentry. Sir John had been knighted in the field for bravely battling the Cornish rebels in the time of Henry the Seventh. Now, Jane had wanted to be a nun, good Catholic girl then. She was brought up in the family home, Wolf Hall. That's the English name, but back in the day it was more the Saxon Wolf Hall, which had come from the original Ulf's Hall. The current Wolf Hall, that is Jane's Wolf Hall, is about 300 years old, so I'm thinking a bit of a dump, really, compared to the more modern manors. Sir John, though, had built onto the place a gallery where you could exercise on a wet day, like it is right here where I am. Another fucking wet day. Jesus. Oh, no, shouldn't complain about rain in winter where I live in Australia. It's a good thing. The founder of the Seymour family was a Norman knight, William St. Maur. He'd turned up in England with Bill the Bastard in 1066, and the family have had some jobs like sitting in Parliament, stuff like that. Sir John currently holds the post of Sheriff of Wiltshire and is a Justice of the Peace. Now, Sir John does have 1,240 acres of land. That's pretty frickin' big. And he's into the wool creation business. Yeah, he's a sheep guy. Jane's mum, Marjorie Wentworth, had a bit of the royal blood in her. Not much, but a bit. Marjorie herself had been maid, or apprentice lady, really, to the Duchess of Norfolk, where she met the poet John Skelton. Now, Skelton really liked the look of her, and she became his muse, so there's poetry written about her. Marjorie was also related to the Howards. Now, two of her cousins will be parents of two of Henry's wives, Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard. She met young Sir John shortly after he'd been knighted, and he was totally smitten. Now, Jane is about 18, and it's family trouble at home. This is put down to Jane's dad, Sir John, banging his daughter-in-law, Edward's Mrs. Catherine. Who knows, but Jane is 18, so it's off to the convent for her. Thing is, young Jane had this image, perhaps, of a very holy life. Lots of nice praying and singing baby Jesus songs, but the reality of a convent might have been a fair bit different. Cold place, crap food, not enough food, shitty clothes, hard work. At the end of a probationary period, Jane will be off home. Family will welcome her, give her a hot bath, good feed, and that's it. Jane will say, yeah, look, I'd still like to be a nun, but only if you can find somewhere nice. Jane's at home again and will notice that not is all well with brother Edward and his missus. Edward had scored an appointment with Mary Tudor as a page boy and gone to France with her for a marriage. He'll be knighted like his dad in the field in France when he worked for Charles Brandon. He'll then get a job as one of Henry Fitzroy's men. Now, Jane has given up on the nun thing and is waiting for a handsome man to come along and marry her. Waiting, waiting, waiting. What could be wrong? Dad can pay a decent dowry, so it's not the money. Could it be that she's not terribly good-looking? Has she got anything going for her? Very pale skin, apparently. What chap we got? She is of middle height, and nobody thinks she has much beauty. Her complexion is so whitish that she might be called rather pale. Yeah, if you check out the Hans Holbein picture, you might see a rather plain-looking girl. That's me trying to be nice. Yeah, no, she's a bit ugly, really. She is not a woman of great wit, Chapuis goes on, but she may have a fine enigma. That means secret, so he might be talking about her girly bits. It is said that she is rather proud or haughty. Now, it might be her ordinariness that Henry is hot for. He's just had two powerful, intelligent wives. Great, but they can be a bit demanding. Henry's had scenes and squabbles, and he surrounded himself with Boleyn types rather than his old mates. He might want peace and tranquillity in a missus who is perhaps just obedient. Jane seems to be quiet, calm, and, best of all, submissive. Now, Catherine Philol, the wife of Edward Seymour, Jane's brother, will find herself disinherited in the family will. Something fishy is going on with these two, and that would have caused tension in the family. Catherine being disinherited would be a blow to the family's future income. Well, to be accurate, really, Catherine is mentioned in the family will. It says Catherine should get herself off to a convent. Edward will be selected to go on an embassy to France with Wolsey, so he's out of the way. Jane, meantime, having given up on the nun thingy and with no handsome men looking away, will ask to go to court to be a lady. Sir John will get in touch with a bit of a distant cousin, Sir Francis Bryan, vicar from hell. Edward will come home early from that embassy. Something's up. Catherine will be off to a convent. Something's definitely up. Edward will disinherit the two kiddies she had. Maybe with him, maybe not. Now, there's no evidence that the family problem was Sir John banging his daughter-in-law, but it's good enough circumstances for people to believe. Bear in mind, at this time, this is full-on incest, so the family would do whatever they could to keep it quiet. Keep calm, carry on. Sir Francis Bryan, vicar from hell, will get that appointment for Jane to be one of Catherine's ladies. How exciting. But no, sorry, hang on, not one of Catherine's ladies just yet. One of Catherine's maids. That's an apprentice lady. We don't have a precise year for this, but certainly she's in there by 1532, but it could have been as early as 1527. Now, this girl's a bit of a nobody, so nobody actually thought to write much about her. That, then, is a bit of an introduction to Jane Seymour. Then in 1533, Catherine will have her household reduced by Henry. She can only keep 10 ladies, and Jane Seymour will be out. She's not going to make the cut. She has to go home to Wolf Hall. 2 years of quiet country life again, and then Sir Francis Bryan, vicar from hell, will come good again and get Jane back to court as one of Anne's ladies. Jane, then, has certainly seen the nasty side of Henry. Jane also, as a nice Catholic girl, had a lot of sympathy for Lady formerly Princess Mary. It won't be long before Chapuis is reporting that Henry's mates are coaching Jane Seymour on how to win a sociopathic king. Anne is creating lots of legal and religious controversy, so Jane will steer clear of that stuff. The other thing, Jane, is not to comply with Henry's wishes, they're telling her. No kingly hand down the knickers or letting him tweak your nipple. If he happens to propose marriage, then sure, yeah, say yes, but nothing else. If you happen to have a nice private chat with Henry, be sure to remind him that people hate his current marriage. Perhaps then this is Jane who is the wicked temptress rather than Anne. She's complying with those instructions. If we go with contemporary sources, then it certainly looks that way. Whereas with Anne, there's nothing in the contemporary sources that suggested she was a wicked temptress. Her wicked temptress story comes from historians. If we look harder, we get lots of writings from George Cavendish, Wolsey's man, who was against Anne, but never mentioned anything other than Henry was chasing Anne, not Anne chasing Henry. Our go-to man for Jane Seymour is Chapuis, who is very pleased with Jane, but writes about her looking to trap her prey Henry. He wrote that if Jane succeeds in being the queen, then things will look up for Lady formerly Princess Mary. Now Jane will play the game. Henry will send her a purse full of gold and a letter. Jane will accept neither. She will kiss the letter and hand it back to the messenger, saying she was a well-born damsel and a daughter of a good but humble parents without blame of any kind, and nothing matters to her so much as her honour, and on no account would she lose it, even if she had to die 1,000 deaths. Please ask Henry to send the money again, once God has given her an advantageous marriage. Henry will say, okay, I get it, you're Miss Modest. We'll only meet when we're chaperoned by your family. Here, I'll give your brother a nice room at court where we can meet. Jane will regretfully decline, and Henry will want her all the more. In comes Anne to see Henry, and what's this? Jane Seymour is sitting on Henry's knee. Anne will hit the roof. Now, that's a big mistake in my book. She should have put on the waterworks and walked quietly away and wait for Henry to turn up and say, Oh, my dear sweetie, how can I make this better? Then Jane will be seen wearing a necklace that Henry had given her. Anne will rip it off. Not a mistake in my book. Back to Henry, who will be stunned to find Paul III has issued a papal bull depriving him of his kingdom. The same bull tells Frankie Big Nose to get over to England and do that depriving. Frankie Big Nose has no intention of invading England and will try to use this as leverage to get Henry into a stupid foreign war in Italy. Henry, though, is too worried about domestic fallout from what's going on and is running around being useless, as is his council. Henry will summon the leading bishops to London for a talk fest. The bishops will get to work countering the papal brief, and championing this will be Stephen Gardiner Buhis, who has been on the outer with Henry and Anne with his resistance to the supremacy thing. He was probably lucky to survive that. Here he goes then. The Pope laments the death of bad men, like Fisher, and rejoices in those of the good. He bemoans Fisher's death as monstrously cruel, when in fact it was the gentlest that could be devised, and he was killed with a sudden stroke of the sword. Yeah, take that, Alessandro Farnese. This is a first emotional draft. Gardiner, Buhis, will write better stuff. De vera obedientia, of true obedience, which defends the royal supremacy and Gardiner's back. I once swore an oath to the Pope, but now I can see I was wrong. And fuck that oath, because the law says no man is bound to take an oath that is illegal. Anybody else who swore an oath to the Pope is also released for the same reason. Now, Stephen Gardiner will be sent to France on embassy work, and look, this could be that Henry saw the court wasn't big enough for both Cromwell and Gardiner, and that's it, Stephen Gardiner's off for 3 years. Chapuis will have a dinner party. Nice, impressive guest list. Henry Powell, Lord Montagu, is one. Henry is the son of Margaret Powell and brother of Reg Powell, who will be back in the story soon. Reg is currently back in Venice writing In Defence of the Unity of the Church, and that will not please Henry. Also at that dinner party is Henry Courtenay, Marquess of Exeter, whose granddad was Ted IV. We should have a lady there, so he's the Countess of Kildare, who was Elizabeth Grey and half-cousin to Henry. This is Team Lady, formerly Princess Mary. Henry will tell Chapuis that Anne and Cromwell are now on bad terms, and the king was talking up a new marriage. Cromwell was, as Sir St. Thomas Fool might have said, crom unwell. He's getting on to 50. He's taken up using spectacles. Had to take sick leave to the point where Henry actually visited Tom at home. That got him back to work. 1535, and we're getting into the dissolution of the monasteries. All monasteries must go. Well, not yet. But some monasteries must go so we can get them into cash earners for the king. Cromwell can now rip it up the bishops. Can the king unmake a bishop, he asked them. Oh, quick check of legislation will make them say, yeah, he can. Tom by now has turned into the political superior of the nobility, including our dukes. He might still be their social inferior, but he wants them to acknowledge his superiority in government. Cromwell can engineer a noble's appointment to jobs away from London to help him get them out of the way so he can get on further. And by now, he's built up a network of spies, both domestically and in foreign countries. Information is power, and Tom's getting it. That means Tom himself can stick close to Henry. Tom's removing his court enemies one by one. Now, Cromwell has been giving Tom Howard, Duke of Norfolk, such a hard time that Howard will go off home to sulk for a couple of years. He'll be back. Howard's man, Stephen Gardiner, who his thing got sidelined and had to hand over the master secretary job to Cromwell. Still, Cromwell can't help himself and will continue to humiliate Gardiner at every opportunity. Good to make enemies. Now, it was Cromwell who had Gardiner off to a 3-year embassy in France, but like his mate Tom Howard, Stephen Gardiner, who his will be back. Tom will send messages to the bishops, nobility, justice of the peace, telling them to toss in the slaver any churchy types who have been seduced with the filthy and corrupt abominations of the Bishop of Rome or his disciples or adherents. Those messages will have both his and Henry's seal. He's come a long, long way. He's come a long, long way together, through the hard times and the good. I have to celebrate you, baby. I have to praise you like I should. Sending out letters to these bishops are one thing, but Cromwell wants to put the frighteners out there. We have those three Carthusian monks executed for not recognising Henry's supremacy. In comes another three, and the jury look like they want to acquit these guys until Cromwell goes and has a little word in their ear. Guilty then. Tom will want the full penalty, a total hung, drawn and quartered thing. By the time we get to Fisher and Moore's death, the population certainly had the message, and whatever they think, they'll say, yeah, sure, Henry's the head of the church. Smart population. April 1535, and Cromwell will start his census of churchy lands and revenues. This will be known as the Valo Ecclesiastia, the value of the church. How about that? The value of the church. And this is a huge piece of work. It's the most detailed bit of work on England since the Domesday Book back in 1086. It may have been just intended as a method of collecting tax or ensuring we keep corruption to a minimum. But when we start to see what Henry could gain from all that, then the temptation will be a bit too much. At this time, the church may have held up to two-thirds of English land. They've done well, haven't they, the church? This will be the height of Anne and Tom Cromwell working together for the Reformation and the start of the end of their relationship, with Anne wanting some of that stuff to go to charitable causes. Cromwell and Henry want it all for the king. Cromwell will suspend the authority of each and every bishop. They're all powerless, and he'll get two results from this. First, his guys can get on with the census of churchy assets unimpeded, and secondly, he'll get to restore the powers of the bishops one by one. As each guy comes in to get his powers restored, Cromwell will make it plain that they now work for the government. If the king should die, then so will their powers, so they'll need to be good boys. Just to smart them up a bit more, Tom will withhold some of their powers, like probate that attracted big fat fees. Some of Tom's inspectors will help out by reporting stuff like monks who are frequently pissed and just spend their days playing cards. There'll be plenty more like that, which will be great for Tom to take to the council or parliament. It will work, and the final session of the Reformation Parliament will tick off on the dissolution of the religious houses with an income of less than £200. We're doing it to fight corruption. That's our main reason. That's why we're really doing it. And, yeah, sure, Henry will get the money, but we're doing it to fight corruption. Easter 1536, Cromwell will get Chapuis to open dialogue with Super Sausage Chuck to resolve his and Henry's differences. Chuck to facilitate a reconciliation between Henry and Paul III, our new Pope. If God fails to give Henry a son, then he is open to renaming Lady formerly Princess Mary as heir to the big chair. And lastly, Henry will help Chuck against Suleiman the Magnificent and Frankie Big Nose in Milan. Chapuis will go off for a follow-up meeting with Henry and, as usual, fail to kiss Anne's hand. Off we go to Mass then, and Henry and Anne will descend from their pews by the staircase, one on each side. You got the king's side and the queen's side. And that will bring Anne face to face with Chapuis. The mob will gather around, they want to see this. Anne will give Chapuis a nod, and Chapuis can do nothing other than a little bow. But that's enough. Chapuis has finally acknowledged Anne as queen, even if he was forced into it. Lady formerly Princess Mary will be outraged. Henry, meantime, is having a stoush with Cromwell. Cromwell was so upset he had to go and sit down quietly and compose himself. Having done that, Henry will go to Chapuis and refuse each of the proposals one by one. Henry does not like this deal, really, that Cromwell's hatched. Cromwell will later tell Chapuis that was the moment he decided Anne must go. She's been interfering with foreign policy, telling Henry he should be on Team Frankie Big Nose, not Super Sausage Chuck. Mind you, anything Cromwell says to Chapuis should be taken with a grain of salt. It could just be the diplomatic bullshit. We should be happy to hear that in his chat with Chapuis, Henry referred to Anne as our most dear and entirely beloved wife, the Queen. That's nice to say out loud, but she won't be mentioned in any of the documents. A week later, and it's the annual Garter Knight Day. Now, one knight had died the previous year, leaving one vacancy. It's down to George Boleyn or Sir Nicholas Carew, Master of the Horse. The vote will be undecisive, so it's down to Henry to pick. Carew will get the gig. Anne will be pissed off. Nicholas Carew also happened to be the main supporter in court of one James Seymour. Same day, and we'll get an Oyer and Terminer Commission, that's going to be called. there. I think we've had Aware and Terminer before, haven't we? The Hear and Determine. Might have had it before. To hear and determine is a thing, but to determine what? Generally, these things are about treason. On top of this, Parliament will be called, and the previous very long Reformation Parliament had just been dissolved. We never call another Parliament straight after a previous Parliament. Something's brewing. The gossip is out. The gossip says Anne will be divorced and Lady Mary will go back to Princess Mary. You can be re-legitimised if the churchy types think your parents were acting in good faith when your mum got knocked up. At this stage, our advice to Anne Boleyn is to stay cool and just don't do anything to upset anyone. Yeah. 26th of April, Anne will call her chaplain in for a private chat. He will later reveal that Anne had asked him in this conversation to take care of baby Betty's spiritual welfare should anything happen to her. Perhaps she's a worried queen, but is it Henry she's worried about? Shouldn't be, because a couple of weeks earlier, Henry was still pushing for Europe to recognise his marriage to her. Maybe she's worried about Cromwell. She certainly had another blue with Tom Cromwell and told him she would like to have his head off. Ooh. 29th of April, Anne will wander into a room where our musician Mark Smeaton is looking at something. He's playing like one of those courtly love guys who is smitten by the love that cannot be type thingy. Anne will say, "Hey Mark, why so sad?" Mark will say, "It's nothing," and give a big old sad lover type sigh. Oh. Wrong answer, mate. You're just a commoner. So Anne will say, "Don't think I'll be talking to you like you're some noble man, mate. You're an inferior." "Of course not," says Mark. "Just a look from you is fine, and so farewell." Now, next day, Anne will be chatting to a real noble, Henry Norris, groom of the stool. Henry is a young, wealthy widower who's been having a bit of that Margaret Shelton, Anne's cousin, but he's not committing to her. Margaret Shelton is getting a bit of a reputation as the court bike. You know, everybody's had a ride. So, may not be marriage material for this Henry, plus getting involved with the Boleyn extended family may not be a cool thing to do right now. Anne will be sticking up for Margaret. "Hey, Henry, why haven't you done the right thing and married Margaret?" "Yeah, nah," says Henry Norris, "just hanging out for a while." Anne will say, "You look for dead men's shoes, for if aught came to the king but good, you would look to have me." "Oh, fuck me," says Henry Norris. "If I thought that, my head would be off." And he's dead right, his head would be off. That's imagining the king's death, and it's treason. It's thought crime. This will turn into a dust-up between, and all I can say is, what the fuck was Anne thinking? Henry Norris will try to fix it up, telling Anne's almoner that he would swear that the queen was a good woman. That may not improve things, it's just more grist for the mill. More stuff for the gossipers. Henry will get that gossip by the afternoon and confront Anne. She's got nothing to placate this bloke, so he's off to sulk. Anne will bring baby Betty to see Henry. She knows Henry's very fond of the little kitty, so maybe that'll smooth things over. An observer will say that Henry was angry. His mood may be up and down at the moment. The May Day joust will be due the next day, and they'll proceed. The planned progress after it to inspect the Daverports is cancelled. Henry will write to the ambassador in Rome that in all likelihood God will send us male heirs with our most dear and beloved wife, the Queen. Now Cromwell will hear the court gossip and he's going to nab that musician Mark Smeaton, take him into his Stepney home for a little chat. Now perhaps it was this little chat that had resulted in the progress being cancelled. The tournament will go ahead with the King and the Queen attending, all looking very happy. Henry smiling, Anne smiling, then the thing is over, and they will go their separate ways. Anne and Henry will never see each other ever again. Chapuis will report on his conversations with Cromwell and sadly tell us Cromwell laughed at the disintegrating marriage. That's a bit off, Tom. Tom will now be all out looking for evidence that Anne has been naughty. He will even work with Stephen Gardiner Bouhiss, who is still in France. Stephen will write that everybody in France, everybody, knows that Anne is having affairs all over the place. Anne's household members will be rounded up and told to find evidence. And here's some nice gossip for Cromwell. Anne had gone to Francis Weston to tell him to lay off Margaret Shelton because it was intended Margaret would marry Henry Norris. Francis Weston will tell everyone that Henry Norris visited Anne's chambers for Anne, not to see Margaret Shelton. Worse than that, Anne will further accuse the very much married Francis Weston of not loving his missus and spending his time flirting with Margaret Shelton. Weston will say, "Well, I do love somebody more than my wife, but it's not Margaret Shelton." "Who is it?" asks Anne. "It's you, Anne." "Oh, fuck me, Francis Weston, you have just made a big blue there." Now, for us, though, this all just sounds like the courtly love banter. You've got to tell the Queen you love her. But if you're looking for evidence of adultery, then you can just make it sound like, yeah, adultery. I think we might be seeing then why Cromwell set up that Oyer and Terminer. He wants a commission ready to go for some treason charges. Now that might be good for the guys who will be accused, but for the Queen you're going to need a parliament. And, oh, that's right, Tom called that as well. Why the haste, I hear you asking? Well, Henry might just change his mind. And it seems that Tom has decided Anne must go, and perhaps not to a convent. Mark Smeaton then was an easy first target. He's young, common, has no clue about what to say or do, and he's been nabbed. He's a nobody, but Tom can put the frighteners on him and make him say whatever Tom wants him to say. And there's plenty of contemporary statements saying that Tom absolutely did not use torture on this guy. I'm guessing he certainly used psychological torture, but our medieval types don't know about psychological torture. There's also a chance, though, that he went illegal. Now, the illegal torture at this time is a rope around the guy's head, and you slowly tighten that. I don't know why that's illegal when you've got stuff like the rack that is legal. Now, manufacturing evidence for a treason trial is also illegal, so Tom may not have been thinking too much about the law at that time. 1st of May, 1536, 6 p.m. Mark Smeaton will be admitted to the Tower. Cromwell had his confession. Henry, meantime, had ridden off from that tournament in the company of his good buddy Henry Norris. Henry the King will question Henry Norris about his relationship with Anne. "Nothing to tell," says Henry Norris. "Nah, come on," says Henry the King. "You can tell me, and I guarantee you absolute immunity from any prosecution. Just tell me, Henry Norris." "Yeah, nah, nothing going on at all." 2nd of May, Henry Norris is arrested and taken to the Tower. A kind of confession will be got from Henry Norris by Treasurer Fitzwilliam, but he'll later claim that he was deceived to give that confession. This is going okay for Cromwell, but he needs to nail the lid down on the coffin. He can't afford Anne making a comeback later on. Anybody else hate Anne Boleyn? Somebody top-notch? Enter our story again, Charles Brandon, Duke of Suffolk, and Anne Boleyn hater. Charles can help out getting testimony from Anne's ladies. Here's Elizabeth Brown now. She's really known for naughtiness at court. "Yes," says Elizabeth, "I might bang like a dunny door in a hurricane, but I've got nothing on Anne Boleyn." "Oh, fuck me, Elizabeth, you're supposed to be one of Anne's top ladies. Got a good place at the Silly Bee Hatting, and Anne has bailed you out financially, so what gives?" Well, she is Elizabeth Brown, sister of the now deceased Anne Brown, who had been married to Charles Brandon. Elizabeth and Anne have a brother, Anthony, who is in the Privy Chamber and a big supporter of Lady formerly Princess Mary. He was the one who actually took Elizabeth's statement. Yeah, her own brother, Princess Mary supporter. The family of one of Anne's former ladies, Lady Bridget Wingfield, who has been dead for 2 years, will suddenly find a letter from Bridget to Anne, suggesting that Anne was banging around before she married Henry. Kind of. Let me read you the exact passage that said this. "I pray you leave your indiscreet trouble, both for displeasing God and also for displeasing me." Yeah, there you go. You're scratching your head trying to figure that out? I can't help. Well, I can, sort of. Let's read the words that Bridget had failed to put in. Yeah, these words aren't in there. "I pray you to leave your indiscreet trouble regarding the fact that I, Anne, am having an affair, which is upsetting God and upsetting me." Yeah, just bullshit. Now, that letter was written a year before Anne had married Henry. She would have had to have been absolutely fucking nuts to have an affair at that time. Okay, thanks, Bridget, who was once married to Charles Brandon's cousin. Oh, dear. The cousin died, so Bridget remarried one of Charles Brandon's best mates. The mate of Charles Brandon, that one, is looking to stamp out reform. We have a contemporary source who tells us that guys were going around Anne's ladies with nice fat bribes while assuring them that Henry was looking to give Anne the boot. Can it get worse? And you know it can. Do you remember, my dear listener, that Anne had accused Charles Brandon once of incest? Glad you do, so why not repay the favour and have Anne accused of incest? And we're looking at George Boleyn, who will say at his trial, on the evidence of only one woman, you are willing to believe this great evil of me, and on the basis of her allegations you are deciding my judgment. Who could this one woman be? Well, the consensus view is that it's Mrs. Jane Boleyn. Here Jane had still not been allowed back in court, and she might still be shitty. Even so, Jane will hand over a letter that proves the two were going at it. Now, what's this letter all about? Anne wrote to George saying she was up the spout. Yes, sister tells brother she is pregnant, so he must be the dad? Yeah, I don't know. What's in this for Brandon apart from revenge? Well, if Anne goes down for adultery, then baby Betty will be a bastard, just like a half-sister lady formerly Princess Mary. That would happen to make Charles kiddies with Mary Tudor, the heir to the big chair, and the money would start rolling in. Plus, with the Boleyn faction out of the way, Charles can come back to be a big swinging dick at the court. Cromwell will write to Stephen Gardiner, who hiss, the Queen was living such a debauched lifestyle, her offences towards the King were so rank and common that her ladies of the Privy Chamber could no longer cover for their depraved and sinful Queen. But I won't go into details because it is so abominable and I cannot bring myself to repeat it. Yes, perhaps he hasn't just finished making it all up. It will end up that Anne was banging five guys, not including Henry the King. Now, this is a bit impossible to believe. She could be doing five guys without any one of them being discovered, and then suddenly we discover all five. Anne would have known that at court she was being spied on pretty much all the time. She's got too many enemies for that not to be happening. Any lady who had been complicit in not revealing an affair would also be culpable of treason. But no ladies were arrested. Chapuis, who is definitely not on Team Anne, will say she was condemned upon presumption and certain indications without valid proof or confession. Henry Percy will be brought in for a chat. Is it not true, Percy, that you had, in fact, married Anne, so her marriage to Henry is bigamous and not valid? Henry Percy will for once be strong and just say, nah. Anne will be arrested. She first had to face a commission that included Uncle Norfolk Tom Howard. It hasn't been quite 3 years since her silly behatting. Anne will arrive at the tower, but as queen, she can go through the front door and not the traitor's gate. Well, not really the front door. She goes through the private door that is the royal's door. The cannon will fire so everybody knows a noble is in the tower. Anne will ask if she's off to the dungeon. Nah, you can go to the same rooms you had for the silly behatting. Anne will finally break down. Boo-hoo-hoo. It's too good for me. She'll then start laughing, and there are reports that she will laugh a fair bit more during her stay in the tower. I'd say she might be totally stressed and just a tiny bit hysterical, poor love. George Boleyn will be arrested a few hours after Anne. Henry's behaviour in this again points to the sociopath. What a sociopath does, you get in there, you charm the knickers off your desired girlie. Once you've got her in a firm relationship, you start to devalue her. And finally, you discard her with not a backwards glance.
She got away with that as a disgrace.
Disgrace?
It's a disgrace to our country.
It was a disgrace.
What a disgrace.
It's 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 a disgrace.
Henry won't be talking to George Blin either. At least Henry had chatted with Henry Norris. Not that that did Henry Norris any good. But Anne, his wife, and George, his brother-in-law, won't get a word. The confessions aren't going up very well. Mark Smeaton had broken down, but he's an easy target and small fry. Henry Norris's confession was pretty skinny, and Anne and George aren't bringing us anything.
He thinks, what we do here in England, we send our children into other households when they are young, and so it is not rare for a brother and sister to meet when they are grown, as if for the first time. Think how it must be, then. This fascinating stranger whom you know, this mirror of you. You fall in love, just a little, for an hour, an afternoon, and then you make a joke of it. The residual drag of tenderness remains. It is a feeling that civilizes men and makes them behave better to dependent women than otherwise they might. But to go further, to trespass on forbidden flesh, to leap the great gap from a fleeting thought to action. Priests tell you that temptation slides into sin, and you cannot put a hair between. But surely that is not true. You kiss the woman's cheek? Very well. Then you bite her neck? You say, sweet sister. And then next minute you flip her back and cant her skirts up? Surely not. There is a room to be crossed and buttons to be undone. You don't sleepwalk into it. You don't fornicate inadvertently. You don't fail to see the other party, who she is. She doesn't hide her face. But then, it may be that Jane Rochford is lying. She has cause.
Yes, a little bit of Hilary Mantel there. Henry will be off to see his son, Henry Fitzroy, for a good boo-hoo-hoo. Telling Fitzroy that Anne had planned to murder Fitzroy and the lady formerly Princess Mary so that baby Betty would be the sole heir to the big chair. Henry will also carry around a little book where he's written about his heartbreak and all the accusations against Anne, and will read that to anyone who'll listen. Chapuis will write, "You never saw a prince or a man who made greater show of his misfortune or bore them more pleasantly." Yeah, that's more sociopathic behaviour. Is there anything else we can toss in as to why Anne might be falling? Back in 1535, Anne had sent a couple of chaplains on royal envoy to Wittenberg, looking for an alliance with the Protestant princes in Germany. The princes at that time had formed that Schmalkaldic League that we heard of in the Reformation episodes. Henry won't be happy. The Germans wanted more cash than he was offering and refused to send Martin Luther's right-hand man over to England to meet Henry. At the same time, Cromwell was working on an alliance with Super Sausage Chuck, the enemy of the Protestant princes. Cromwell, though, might have been just trying to play one side against the other. Super Sausage Chuck will work out that Anne is working with the princes and be very unhappy about it. Some of our contemporary writers certainly write that Henry laid the blame for this foreign policy stuff-up on Anne. If Cromwell was playing a double game, then he would certainly be efficient at passing any blame on to Anne. King Henry and King Donald are the sort of guys who can never blame themselves. They need to find someone else to blame. And again, that is standard sociopathic behaviour. Back to Anne, who's in the slammer, and she's been given four anti-Anne type ladies to watch over her. Anne, though, will be in a talkative mood. Might not be the smartest thing to do, Anne. She will tell the story about Henry Norris and say she's more worried about Francis Weston, saying he loved her. Sir Francis Weston can now join the others in the tower. Okay, who else can we get in the net? Sir Richard Page, Henry Fitzroy's guardian, can go in, as can Sir Thomas Wyatt, our poet, and he's a mad rooter of women everywhere. Somehow, the other mad rooter of women everywhere, Sir Francis Bryan, Vicar from Hell, won't get a gig in the slammer. We'll get one more guy in, and that is William Brereton. He's a minor official, bit of a nobody, but somehow just assumes that when the authorities come for him, he's a goner. Perhaps it was because he was blocking Cromwell from knocking over some monasteries, and also blocking Cromwell from some local government reforms. He'll be arrested without charge and tossed in the slammer. Cromwell will charge him with banging Anne on the 27th of November last year. Now, it's always best to have a precise date because that looks like you know what you're saying is true. We may have worked that out in more modern times because now it would be on or about the 27th of November to update the same sort of effect. Yeah, we must know what we're talking about. Anne, meantime, is saying, I think Henry is just doing this to test me, and is still laughing. But it's not all giggles, it's mood swings. Anne's all over the shop. One minute she's on about her death, then it's more jokes, and she certainly wants the churchy types in. She'll say at one point that if her bishops went to Henry, they would sort it out for her. Perhaps they would, but Cromwell has blocked access to the king for all of Anne's bishops. Archie Tom Cranmer will manage to write to Henry, tough letter. He wants to support Anne, but that might mean he's saying Henry is wrong about her, and you can't tell King Henry or King Donald that they are wrong and still live or keep your job. I am in such a perplexity that my mind is clean amazed, for I never had a better opinion in a woman than I did in her, which makes me to think that she should not be culpable. And again, I think your highness would not have gone so far, except she surely had been culpable. Yes, I am not a lot of help there from the Archie. He's just saying he can't believe that Anne's done bad stuff, but she must have, because Henry said she did. Wherefore I trust that your grace will bear no less entire favour unto the truth of the gospel than you did before. For as much as your grace's favour to the gospel was not led by affection unto her, but by zeal unto the truth. Yeah, so our Archie is more interested in religion than helping out Anne. Now, Cranmer has copped a lot of stick over this letter over the years, but I'm okay with it. For a start, like Cranmer, I tried to take two sides of an argument. He wrote his truth. He can't see that Anne is wrong, but of course he can't see that Henry is wrong. If he had seen that Henry was wrong, then the best he would be is out of a job. Then he can't help Anne or anybody else. So he looked at what was important and defended the Reformation. Besides, at this time, Henry wouldn't have given a toss. He's looking at the maidenly delights of Jane Seymour and can't wait to get her wedded and, more importantly, bedded. Anne is still talking. Will I get justice? She asked Kingston, Lieutenant of the Tower. The poorest subject of the land will get justice, says Kingston. Yeah, that's a standard response. It means nothing. Anne will laugh. I will get justice, she says. They have no witnesses because nothing happened. Standard process in a treason trial is that the accused will be questioned by a commission first and their responses recorded verbatim. There are no records of this going on to Anne or the co-accused. Cromwell, Audley and the awful Sir Richard Rich will decide they won't get much more out of our prisoners and so will work with what they've got. First, let's see, we've got the confession of Mark Smeaton, then we've got the court gossip and what the ladies had said, including Anne's own comments in the tower, and lastly we've got a couple of lads known for banging around wherever they can. That last one will be very useful for us in invoking moral outrage. Adultery with multiple partners, including Anne's own brother, is looking great for the prosecution. Page and Tom White will be discarded, but that still leaves five lovers for Anne. Time to get down and dirty. How did Anne seduce George? Alluring him with her tongue in his mouth and his tongue in her mouth. Right-minded people will think that burning her and quartering him are too good for them. She, following her daily, her frail and carnal lust, did falsely and traitorously procure by base conversations and kisses, touchings, gifts and other infamous incitations, divers of the king's daily and familiar servants to be her adulterers and concubines. Yes, I'm sure our lady listeners would know that it's all Anne's fault. She's to blame. Here's Anne then, presented as having a nice male harem, but her lust is insatiable, so she would need to get the king out of the way to continue and expand her carnal desires. Well, she is a wicked temptress after all. She ensnared Henry, broke his marriage to dear, sweet, innocent Catherine, ripped it up dukes, drove Catherine to an early grave, plotted the death of Henry Fitzroy and the lady formerly Princess Mary, and had two saints, Fisher and Moore, executed. Shit, this chick has zero morals. The prosecution rests. No, they don't. We haven't got to trial yet. Worse, always. Henry is now talking up that Anne had fucked somewhere around 100 guys. Back to the Oyer and Terminer, which will sit in Westminster Hall with a jury. The ordinary types can go in there, but George and Anne need trial by their peers, the nobles. The peers are handily both judge and jury in these things. 12th of May and the four gentlemen, Norris, Weston, Brereton and Smeaton, are in. There's a nice jury there. It's full of Cromwell's men or anti-Anne men. Smeaton will cop a guilty plea and say he and Anne had got it on three times. The other three will plead not guilty. Verdict is guilty. Sentence is death. Given that these four guys are guilty of banging Anne, then her day in court is looking pretty shaky. It's to be hung, drawn and quartered, but I can let you know it'll be downgraded to beheading. Only Henry the King could do that, and if he really thinks they were guilty, then why the mercy? He's not really known for it. For security reasons, yeah right, security reasons, Anne and George will be tried in the Tower. Same as for security reasons, Julian Assange is being held in a nasty slammer and refused bail. Amid this tight security, we'll build stands for a couple of thousand spectators to the trial of the century. Uncle Tom, Duke of Norfolk, will be Lord High Steward for the day. Among the peers will be Henry Percy, her former true love and a broken man. And of course we'll have those very judges who knelt before Anne on the day of her coronation. And the last time she saw those guys, they all said how much they loved her.
It is a sad day for England when nobles do not rise for their queen.
And even sadder when that same queen is charged with adultery and incest.
Charged is not convicted, Uncle. Or is it in this court?
Master Cromwell, read out the indictment.
The charge is that in the 28th year of the reign of our sovereign Henry, King of England, his wife, the Queen, being seduced by the devil, did knowingly commit incest, high treason, and offences against God.
Anne, of course, is fucked, but not George so far. Anne was principally charged with having cohabitated with her brother and other accomplices. That there was a promise between her and Norris to marry after the king's death, which it thus appeared they hoped for, and that she poisoned Catherine, and intrigued to do the same with Mary. And of course, Anne will have no legal counsel. Anne will answer all charges, denying the lot, and giving plausible answers to the lot of them. And that will be guilty. The prosecution called zero witnesses. Anne is guilty of treason, and for a girlie, that means burning. But Uncle Norfolk will say that she should be burned or beheaded at the king's pleasure. Ooh, say the peers who have finally found their voice. That's not the law. You can't say that. Penalty is burning, Tom. Anne will remain composed and say she was resigned to the fact that she would die, but it was sad that innocent boys would have to go too. Anne will be taken out. George will be brought in. But they won't meet in that there'll be no last look at each other. George will put up a good defence. We're very impressed with George, but then he'll fuck it right up. Now, the charges include that George had stayed in Anne's bedroom one night and that he had once joked that baby Betty might not be Henry's kitty. Another of the charges against him, though, is that his Mrs. Jane Boleyn had said that Anne Boleyn had told Jane Boleyn that Henry was no good in bed with women and that he had neither potency nor force. That means Henry couldn't get it up. The charge was not read out because that's way too delicate. We can't read that stuff out in court. Now, Cromwell had warned George against saying those exact words, But George wanted to spite Cromwell, so when he was handed that charge on a bit of paper in writing, he said it out loud. And if you say the words, you own the words. Now, to tidy this up, it does actually look like Anne might have said something like, Henry can't get it up. Jane Boleyn had been brought in for questioning. That could be serious trouble for Jane. Have you ever been brought in for questioning, my dear listener? I have. It is zero fun. Apart from herself, if George goes down, she might be penniless and out in the street. Now, Jane, like everybody else at the time, was totally ignorant of the charges. Who were involved, what other people had said, this or that. So it's all very scary for her. All she knew was that George had been arrested. And once again, no transcript. That's very unusual. So Jane Boleyn's in there with some professional interrogators, and look, I can't throw any blame at this girl for whatever she said. Jane will write to George saying that she would look to speak with Henry on his behalf, but we know she's got zero chance of seeing the king. Uncle Tom Howard will call for the verdict. Henry Percy will collapse. Fair enough, he's dying. All the others will say guilty. Now, where's Tom Boleyn in this? Well, he wasn't actually invited to the trial, despite the historical fiction writers who liked to have him there and condemning his own daughter. A bit earlier, Henry had called for a complete list of the Boleyn assets, George's and Tom's. That looks like they both might lose everything. Now, Tom Boleyn, like Archie Cranmer or anybody else on Team Anne, would know that intervening would most likely mean you're going to go down with the ship. The only thing you can do in these circumstances is try to protect yourself when this shitstorm's flying overhead. Seems clear to me that Henry was thinking of tossing Tom Boleyn under a bus too. After the verdict, though, Henry will go into party mode. She on my jock, huh? Now stop when we in the spot. Booty moving weight like she on the block. With a drink, I got to know. Top jeans tattoo, cause I'm rock wrong. Half black, half white, diamond, no. Gang of money. Yeah, it's all lots of feasting and laughs for Henry. Jane Seymour will be moved into a residence a mile up the road, and her servants will be told to give her the best of everything. As for the friends and family of the prisoners, that will be a time of anguish and hope. Will they receive a kingly pardon? It can happen. Archie Tom Cranmer will help Henry out by granting a decree of nullity. Henry had banged Mary Boleyn, so his marriage to Anne was void. Baby Betty is a bastard. Anne is no longer queen. And Anne has seen how Henry has treated his other, now bastard, daughter Mary, so that might have worried her all the more. Anne will be wondering if she's going to burn or be allowed to go off to a convent. I think we all know she's not going to a convent. She's a strong woman who would put up a lifelong fight to protect the interests of baby Betty, and Henry doesn't want that. News will come in that she is granted a nice beheading. A really nice beheading. Henry will get in an expert swordsman from France and not have some apprentice with an axe who might get it all wrong. Is this mercy from Henry, or just good optics for the mob? The whole split with Anne is a PR disaster, though it might be just good optics. Anne is on death row, and her mental state is not good as you'd expect. Now, generally, it's guilty, and you're on your way to the execution in pretty short time. 15th of May was Anne's trial, and the four guys are due to die on the 17th, but no word on Anne's date with death. Now, just knowing the date would be helpful. Being left in limbo is cruel. For the four boys, then, that might be a bit of mercy, knowing when they would be going. George spent his time writing about who he owed money to so that they would get paid. Now, George is generally depicted as a money grubber who was power hungry, and he might have been those things, but he was also the governor of Bedlam, the mental institution, so he might have been into a bit of helping people as well. George will also write to his parents to apologise for ending up this way. I should have lived by the Gospels, he says. If I'd done that, then I wouldn't be here. I thought I'd have another 30 years to make amends for my youthful follies, but turns out I haven't. Off they go then to a beheading, and they're dead. Anne reportedly said she was concerned for Mark Smeaton's soul, given that he had made a false confession. The boys have gotten a semi-private execution on Tower Hill. No common smelly types allowed, just the nobility to watch. Well, not really. The gates are left open for common smelly types, but without a time set for the execution. You only get your die-hard fans of beheadings there. Next day, 18th of May, and Anne will get the news that she's to go the next day, 19th. She'd asked Kingston, the lieutenant of the Tower, to listen in on her mass, where she would swear her innocence on the Holy Sacrament, the bread without yeast that turns into the real baby Jesus. Okay, she's heard mass and is ready to die at 9 a.m. on the 19th. But that won't happen. More mental torture. In comes Kingston to say, yeah, just delayed a bit. This could be more about crowd control because Anne is also down to get done on the Tower Green. No foreigners allowed, but again, common smelly types can come in, but they're expecting a morning job, so they probably wander it off after an hour or two. Crowd control is a good idea because who knows what Anne might say in her last words. We can have a good guess because it was a really bad and stupid thing to say bad things about the king even right at the end. Your family might get it after you go. Anne will say to Kingston, here say I shall not die afore noon, and I am very sorry therefore, for I thought then to be dead and past my pain. No, says Kingston, it won't be painful. Anne says, I heard the executioner was very good, and I have a very little neck. Finally, her time has come, and off she goes to the scaffold. There will be about 1,000 people there. Her last view in life will be the northern walls of the White Tower. That's the part where the toilets are pulled out. It's a wall of human crap. She will look behind her frequently, and we can only guess why. My guess was hope for a pardon. But it could be that she was just worried about our executioner, that he might pull a sudden move on her. All other reports will say that she was very calm. No pardon comes in, so time for last words. Best result for the government is that you make a final confession, but that won't happen. If you hear this one, alas, poor head, in a very brief space thou wilt roll in the dust of this scaffold, and, as in life thou didst not merit to wear the crown of a queen, so in death thou deservest not a better doom than this. And, yeah, I'm going to call bullshit. That was written by a Portuguese gentleman, and we had a firm policy of no foreigners allowed. Plus he goes on, and ye, my damsels, who, whilst I lived, ever showed yourself so diligent in my service. Yeah. But we know those ladies weren't there, her ladies. It was just those anti-Boleyn women who had been in the Tower with her. Mind you, those four women will boo-hoo-hoo. Not much comfort to Anne. So let's try this one.
Good Christian people, I am come hither to die. For according to the law, and by the law, I am judged to die.
Yeah, I can't hear her. And therefore, I'm speaking. I think she'd speak up for a last word.
Okay, let's have another go.
Good Christian people, I have come here to die according to the law and thus yield myself to the will of the king, my lord.
Now, that's close, but the Tudor scriptwriters had to edit it and fiddle around with it, so bugger on. Let's try one more time.
Good Christian people, I am come hither to die. For according to the law, and by the law, I am judged. And therefore I will speak nothing against it. I am come hither to accuse no man, nor to speak anything of that whereof I am accused and condemned to die. But I pray God save the king, and send him long reign over you, for a gentler nor more merciful prince was there never. And to me he was ever a gentle, a good, and a sovereign lord. And if any person will meddle of my cause, I require them to judge best. And thus I take my leave of the world, and of you all. And I heartily desire you all to pray for me. Lord, have mercy on my soul.
To God I commend my soul.
Apportez l'épée.
Stevie Ray Vaughan there and Little Wing to get us into some historical fiction. And this week I had a crack at the movie Anne of a Thousand Days, came out in 1969, which is probably when I last saw it. So 1969, was that 51 years ago? We've got Richard Burton as the Mad Welsh King in this one. And because he's the star of the show, they're going to bugger around with the story a bit. But we start off with a young Anne who's madly in love with Harry Percy, totally pissed off with Henry and Wolsey because they break that up. But then Henry forces her to come to court, and once she's in court, then he will shower her with gifts, but more importantly, give her a bit of power. And this Anne Boleyn likes that power. She thinks that's pretty good. Why wouldn't she? She's very smart. She's just smarter than Henry or Wolsey. So then we get the story through to the trial, and they bugger around with the trial a bit because their big star is Richard Burton, and they want him in there. Then they bugger around again with Anne on death row, again because they want Richard Burton in there to have a big final confrontation with Anne. Anne then will die, but she dies saying that her daughter Elizabeth will be a better king than Henry. And yeah, we know she's right in that. Well, maybe you don't, my dear listener. Spoiler alert, Elizabeth, baby Betty, will be a better king than Henry VIII. So, all in all, actually, I thought it dated quite well. Anne of a Thousand Days, a thousand days referring to the approximate length of time she lived once she married Henry. But for us, of course, it's a matter of what we go out with. And, of course, Anne Boleyn's gone out, which means we'll be going out with Rick Wakeman and Anne Boleyn. Hope to see you next week. Bye.